Are you looking for a view of the world that's a bit different? Hi, I'm Jason Palmer, a host of The Weekend Intelligence, a podcast from The Economist. Join us to hear the stories that matter most to our correspondents and editors. Every Saturday, we introduce you to people and ideas that take you outside the ordinary and expand your horizons one episode at a time. Join us and see the world from a new perspective. To listen free until May 31st, search Spotify for The Weekend Intelligence.
You have goals. Reach them fast with IU Online's accelerated degree programs. Our 6 and 8 week courses are taught 100% online and can fit any schedule. Advance your career with a bachelor's in mathematics. It only takes 10 minutes to apply. Earn an Indiana University degree that's valued around the world. Get started today at IU Online.
Hey, Derek here. Today's episode is all about Fishkill Hee. Video games, in other words. How they fit into our lives. What they sound like. And who they represent. Obviously, we need to take a special interest in how Ireland and Irishness are represented in video games. If your touchstone game is Tetris, or if you think the pyramids are used for storing grain, don't worry. I'm right there with you. I'm not much of an expert either, but we have much to learn from our two expert guests today. But first, today's episode of Motherfuck Lore is brought to you by the show's supporters on Patreon. Supporters like Ginger Snaps and Adrian McElhom, Kerem Mila Magov, Adrian August Ginger. Supporters of the show get access to bonus content, which they can watch live or follow up afterwards. Discount codes on art and products, different products relating to the Irish language, which change frequently. We're always finding new people to bring. And a range of other features, which are being added all the time. They can also get access to our Discord server, where they can chat with other fans about the show, pitch us episode ideas, all those things. And now, on with the show. From the Headstuff Podcast Network, welcome to Motherfuck Lore, a podcast about words, Irish words and words from Ireland. I am Derek O'Shea.
And I'm Pather O'Quivonic.
How are you getting on, Pather?
Yeah, not bad. Finding this lockdown interminable, but, you know, acquainting myself with some new and old video games to try and pass the time. You're not much of a gamer, are you, Derek?
I'm not. The Joe, who was the best man at my wedding, used to be the video game critic with the Irish Times, and he was a great advocate of how wonderful video games were, and how I was a bit, my dismissal of them was unfair. But I mean, I can see how it's a bit of crack. Like I used to have Tetris on my computer when I was growing up, and I found that was very enjoyable and interesting. But I think there's more to video games than this.
I think it's fair to say that there is more to it than that. Like I'm doing it a disservice by saying it's a valid art form. It's an excellent art form. Like, it's interactive storytelling. I love it. I really enjoy it. I enjoy the escapism of it. I find, as I get older, my imagination is suffering. Like, when I was a kid, I had spaceship games on my Super Nintendo, and I would play Starwing through from start to finish, and then I'd play it again and pretend that I was, you know, flying a fighter in World War II, and then I'd play it again and I'd be back in the spaceship. And now my imagination is so shit, I can't play last year's FIFA because it's got the wrong players. Like, I'm really, really, really struggling. But thankfully, video games are getting better. And we have brought in some people who know more about video games than you, definitely, but also than me. Mm-hmm. They also just happen to be acclaimed best-selling authors. We've got Sarah Maria Griffin and Una Ming Kavanagh. Fáilte romhaibh.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you both getting on? Welcome to Motherfuck Lore.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So I have a question for you both. Who is your favorite Irish video games character?
Okay, Sarah, because you were mentioning this beforehand, I'll let you go first. Because I'm curious.
This is going to require a bit of a stretch on everybody's part. So what I would cordially invite you to suspend your disbelief and come with me on a journey where this is a likely factual case of Irishness in a video game.
Okay.
But I'm going to straight up say, the horse that belongs to Link Zelda, whose name is Epona. named for the Celtic goddess of horses. Epona is Irish. Oh. There you go.
I dig it. I dig it.
Facts, man.
Does Epona have an Irish accent?
I'm not fluent in horse. I've actually only got a couple of words. But I feel like she is. Yeah.
That's amazing. I didn't think of that curveball.
Yes.
And I mean, who do you have a favorite character or?
Yeah, so I was thinking about this, and because there are so many characters that are, to be honest, truly awful, I kind of a sort of a cop out, but a legit character. Liam Neeson plays a character in Fallout 3 called James. It's a protagonist's father, and he basically just plays Liam Neeson, and it's wonderful and it's great because he uses his own accent, and there's no reason as to why he's using his own accent because it's set in the US. And but there he is, and it's I would say out of all of them, like, he's pretty solid in terms of characters. Because when I noticed that he was, when I initially played the game, I was like, yes, I know exactly who this is. He's not even trying. It's great. It's perfect.
Absolutely.
But I don't know. You see, that's just Liam Neeson being Liam Neeson. But he's not, like, he's an American scientist. Like, in the same way that Liam Neeson playing Liam Neeson is an American CIA operative in the Taken series.
I know. But I feel like if he tried an American accent, it'd be terrible.
Yeah, no, it would be awful. And I think, in fairness, if we're going to allow the horse from Hyrule, we have to allow Liam Neeson from Fallout 3.
Do we have worst ones? Do we have...
Do we have any? Are there many at all? You know, like, my big query is that, like, we do we appear in the medium? Like, is the medium so young and so within a very kind of hegemon? Well, it's not. There's a lot of it's exploded, obviously, comparatively recently. But, like, there's a kind of a hegemony of characters, really. There's kind of just like one the other one with H.
Homogeneity.
Thank you, of characters. Like, you don't see, you see a lot of whiteness, certainly, mm-hmm. but you don't see a lot of Irishness, you know, which I think is super, super compelling. Like, I think it's a really interesting absence, most notably because we see a lot of, like, pastoral landscapes used. We see a lot of lush green environments. We see a lot of fae. We see a lot of visual representation, which could be, like, a mystical iteration of Ireland, but we don't see ourselves, I think.
Yeah, and I think those few representations that there are there of Irishness, as Una Ming, you were saying just a few minutes ago, there are some bad ones out there. I mean, some of them that spring to mind, like the character named Irish in Red Dead Redemption, who is a drunken, philandering scoundrel. And then there's Sean Devlin in The Saboteur, who's a drunken, philandering scoundrel. I think, are we in danger of being really typecast here in video games?
I think we've already been typecast. Speaking of the Saboteur game, to be honest, like, first of all, the accent is absolutely diabolical. And one of the lines he uses when he's carrying a bomb is, "Nothing to see here. Nope, nothing special. Ignore the mick with the bomb." Like, come on. Are you serious? Like,
no, I just found it so disappointing. I found it so disappointing around the Saboteur that the performance was such a letdown, because the concept was absolutely stunning. That if anyone hasn't played it, Paris is in black and white. And as you liberate each banlieue from the Nazis, it goes into color. So the closer you get to liberation, the more of Paris is in color. Lovely. It's an absolutely stunning visual concept, but it's ruined by ham acting. One of the worst Irish accents.
But acting in video games is a comparatively recent phenomenon also, because, like, if you think about the video games that, I don't know, Inamin and I are kind of the same age, like, that we would have grown up playing, like, voice acting was the first video game that I played that had voice acting was Final Fantasy X, and I promptly fucking turned it off again because I was so struck by how uncanny it was. I didn't like it. Like, so when we have bad voice acting and bad accent work from the part of some misfortunate actor who signed up to a role in a video game, we're also coupling that with that weird, uncanny delay that you see in even the best CGI renderings of a human face. It will always look wrong. It will always feel wrong. Like, the games that I play tend to be way further down the artsy indie bullshit kind of vein of things rather than the realistic, because I find unstylized photographic renderings of human faces really, like, upsetting. So if you couple that with any sort of ham-fisted acting, how is that meant to be an escapist experience? Like, how are you meant to voyage to another realm when you're like, oh, that just looks like a sock puppet, man. Like, that's bad. At least if it actually looked like a sock puppet, you could be going on an adventure, you know? So I don't know. I have a lot of very strong feelings about Uncanny Valley and the gap between us and the screen.
I think it's a thing as well. It's a sad state of affairs when, you know, if we hear that a character is going to be Irish in a video game, then we instantly wince. Like, that is not the reaction we need. I think the Irishness in video games usually kind of falls into about five different categories. You have like Irish locations in games, then you have random Irish characters in games, then you have actual Irish language games, and then Irish games made in Ireland.
There are lots of ones that are really like, we have an amazing fledgling industry here with people making fantastic work.
I realized I said four instead of five there, but the other category that I meant to say is like just random Irish things that are like randomly shoved into video games too, but I guess they kind of make sense.
That's my favorite especially if it harks back to, we've had a discussion on this podcast before with Orlan Igul about representations of Irish as a stand-in for fantasy languages, and when I see this in video games, I trip balls. Like, that's my favorite. Like, The Witcher 3, when you go to Skellige and it's like half Norse, half Irish pseudo-mythology bullshit. I'm like, these words might sound cool to you, you triple A game developer, but I know what it fucking means.
That's it, yeah. And it's a real shame as well when these things appear in your favorite games. Like, one of my favorite games is the Persona series. And they use a lot of Irish mythology in that. They have Cú Chulainn and Satanta for some strange reason, but anyway. And they have Scathach as well. But it's just kind of like, it's just there. Why?
So, I'm also totally fascinated by how our experience, like our video game canons, are probably all very different as well, Heather and Una. Like, we probably have all played very, very different games. Like, I've never played Persona. There's loads of games that you've even mentioned, and I'm like, nope, I've not played that one.
I was being quiet because I thought I was uncool.
No, I think everybody's personal. I feel like the video games people play tend to be as intimate as the way that we use playlists. Do you know? Mm-hmm. Because there are AAA studio games which are kind of advertise, like I worked in GameStop for 2 years, or unnamed video game store for 2 years. I don't know what it's like to be sort of at the front line of like games that are very intensely pushed by developers, like AAA titles that might be big budget or whatever, the Grand Theft Autos of the world and what have you. I feel like that's even a very dated description, because we haven't had a Grand Theft Auto in forever, but you know what I mean. But then from that, there are all these tendrils of different genres or different kinds of video games. So there isn't really like a canon of work that we can all kind of mutually go, oh well, we've all played this, do you know? Our roots into the medium and the things that we play are likely to be super, super different.
That's really true, because I can't even, there's some games that I know that people rave about and I'm like, I mean, for example, I still haven't played Red Dead 2.
I have never played a cowboy game.
Well, there you go. Exactly.
No, ma'am, I can't. I have a very hard line on video games about sad men.
As a sad man, I really enjoyed. I really enjoyed Red Dead 2. I thought it was a massive, massive leap forward in narrative storytelling in the medium. It actually genuinely broke my heart, even though I could see the developments in the story and I could see the eventual ending coming a mile away, I was still shook when it was done. And it has some positive and negative portrayals of Irishness in it as well. Like, there's one of the main groups of antagonists you face are an Irish gang, and that's just it. Like, there's no other character traits to them that mark them out as specifically Irish other than their names, and they're just Irish and that's it. And that's great. I really like that. That's a positive portrayal of Irishness, because it doesn't mark us out as weird or different, or it doesn't mean that our Irishness gives us a particular flavor in the game. And then one of your cohorts, one of your other people that you work with in the game, is a reckless drunken buffoon who's a big red-headed Donald Gleason clone from Dublin. And you're going like, all the good work you did with the bad guys, you've just undone with one of the good guys. But still, highly recommend the game. I mean, it's unreal. I think
it feels like a very long commitment as a piece of work, though, right? It's a fairly sizable hours wise, you know, like sometimes I look at the length of video games that I used to play when I was a teenager, and I'm like, 80 hours, man, where would I? Who has
I have to say I'm a massive fan of longer games.
I have probably sunk 500 hours into Animal Crossing at least, so I can't really talk, but I find it very tough to get committed to a longer game, aside from currently Animal Crossing.
Animal Crossing, there's a podcast I like called Unorthodox, which deals with Jewish concerns. It covers a range of issues from a Jewish perspective, and somebody worked out if you're an Orthodox Jewish person playing Animal Crossing, how to create an Uruv on the island so that you wouldn't break Sabbath.
Gosh.
A lot of stuff happens on Sundays in Animal Crossing as well. That's really interesting. Yeah, there's a lot to it.
I've never played.
It's dangerous. Just dangerous. Pastoral bullshit of the highest order. Like, it's bucolic nonsense, but it's been great during lockdown.
It strikes me as something that you really get sucked into. I mean, because I think that there's these things where I can see where there's this, an escapist element. And I know that there are some games that are on people's phones where you're creating your own little farm or you're creating something like that. And particularly if anything has a added purchase element, but that can be really a dangerous part to get sucked into.
I do think that there's a big market. Market is such an ugly word, but you know what I mean? That's a big demographic available for non-violent gameplay also. So I think the wide success of things like Animal Crossing is actually due to the fact that people who wouldn't normally believe video games to be for them because they're not interested in shooting things, it's a very welcoming environment because it doesn't require this. And I know video games have now gotten to a point where they're like, even within the games, are like critically looking at, you know, what is it to commit violence within this fiction. But Animal Crossing is just like very chill. And I think that's nice, you know, calls people in, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. Definitely.
So for me, what would probably turn me off something like Red Dead Redemption would be the idea of a game that's narrative is driven around violence or that the gameplay mechanic is shooting things. I'm just not, I struggle with it, you know, in a way that I probably didn't previously.
Of course.
I think that is great about video games as well, is because there are so many genres to choose from, like whatever your interests. In terms of having the casual aspect to it, I don't even really like using the casual aspect because sometimes people think that's a negative thing, but I don't think it is at all. You know, there's kind of like hardcore gamers, casual gamers, and we're already like, there are barriers when it comes to those kind of things. But when anyone brings up the thought of being, you know, video games and violence, I always direct them towards Farming Simulator, which has like esports tournaments and competitions to them, you know, when you're on your tractor and you're having the time of your life. Oh, it's so great.
It's fantastic. I think the language around casual is so interesting as well because it's deeply feminized and it's diminutive. But at the same time, I play video games literally every night. I'm playing a game at the moment called Even the Ocean. I'll play it tonight, probably tomorrow night, then I'll be done because it's very short. But I, on average, will crack through 3 or 4 indie games a month, you know. I play games all the time. In my time off, I watch esports, you know, but they're just very chill esports, you know. It's just it's an odd medium that's still kind of discovering itself, and there isn't really a critical theory, let alone the critical theory that we use to unpack video games, like in this way where we're looking at representations of Irishness, say, or trying to parse out representations of Irishness in its very sparse occurrences. We're using the language of cinema or the language of literature to describe something that is neither.
And that's actually a great point, in that it does seem that journalism about video games is very much in, as it is about podcasts, while we're actually on the topic, is very much in its infancy and find the vocabulary. And about that, I just noticed here there's over 423 entries on terma.ie for video game terminology.
There you are.
Yes.
There you go. I bet Una Ming wrote half of them.
Ha! I wish. I always prompt them though when I need another one. I'm like, hello.
An advanced block is Ard Block Oil.
I use that a lot.
I don't even know what an advanced block is in English.
What's a bell?
Bell, like a cligeen.
Yeah, a cligeen. I guess in Animal Crossing it would be.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Like that's your currency is a cligeen, right?
Oh, so cute. I'd love it. Oh my
god. Great. I
yeah,
love
that'd
that.
Be so great. Let's oh use that. Yeah, yeah.
Definitely, yeah.
You're dealing Clegane.
Oh, yeah, yes.
Oh, Clegane. Ah, Jesus, no. That's great.
So I was doing a bit of research for this one, and one of the things that Unaming just mentioned there was video games set in Ireland.
Yes.
So I had a quick look to see how many video games are set in Ireland. And yeah, an awful lot of them are sports games, obviously, because with all of the Tiger Woods PGA Tour games, you can go to the Irish golf courses, and with the rugby games, you can play against Ireland in Lansdowne Road. I think Croke Park or Lansdowne Road, one of the other is in one of the Madden NFL games. And of course, there is the daddy of all Irish sports video games, Gaelic Games Football and Gaelic Games Football 2 and Gaelic Games Hurling featuring Micheál Ó Muir Hearty.
It was.
And that is, I will say without doubt, the worst sports game ever created.
Yeah, I was going to say a tragedy.
That's a real shame, because there'd be a real, if that was done slightly well, there'd be a real market for it, or there'd be a real audience willing for it. I can see, particularly in a time like now when, you know, it's August, and a lot of people would otherwise be looking forward to an All-Ireland right now.
That would have been ideal, yeah. But I think it was because it was in the mid-noughties or something that it came out. I'm not sure. It was in the noughties, I feel. And the graphics were probably really bad, and it just didn't look very well.
It didn't look well, and it didn't play well. It was really, really clunky. I bought the first one, Gaelic Games Football, and I couldn't bring myself to buy the sequel or the hurling game because it was just so poorly executed. And they fell foul of the same problem that college sports games ran into in the US. Basically, you can't, if an athlete is making no money off the game, you can't go and use their likeness. So because the GAA was an amateur organization, they couldn't use real players. And, you know, every kid wants to play a sports game as their heroes in that sport. Like when I play a baseball game, I want to be the real Boston Red Sox. When I play a FIFA game, I want to be St. Pat's. Like when I was Dublin, I didn't want to be Dublin player number 13. Like, you know what I mean? I wanted to be Jason Sherlock, or I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to be the real players, and it didn't allow for that. So it fell on its arse despite Micheál Ó Muir Hearty's amazing commentary.
There's Dublin player 13. His father's a butcher, and he'll cop you up and so forth. Yeah, I presume they couldn't possibly get at those kinds of jokes. So he's the last man who'll ever let you down. It's his family or undertakers and Gary Zaveen.
I love it though.
Yeah. Yeah, he did have a few gems in there. I remember at halftime, and the players go in there now for their cup of tea and half an orange.
A mandarin. Good old mandarin. Sort you out.
A mandarin. but in the games that are set in Ireland, there's a handful of them that really stuck out to me. There's a one called Clive Barker's Undying, which is a video game written by the guy who wrote the Hellraiser franchise.
Okay, I watched Hellraiser on Friday night. And
it's set entirely in Ireland.
No way.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
No,
it's pretty special, Sarah.
but the thing is, like, so I watched Hellraiser being fully prepared for like raw camp, and was just like, this is one of the most beautiful films I've ever seen in my life, and was like crying during it. So I feel like my tolerance for Clive Barker might be a very different gradient to other people. I deeply appreciate the kitsch. Is it like what kind of bad is it though?
It's a horror FPS, and okay, but see, the problem is first of all, the name of the main character, who's called Patrick Galloway, which is obviously not particularly an Irish name to begin with. And he's going around doing his wee investigation around in the 1920s.
So what year is this made in?
I don't know what year it was made. I'm not too sure actually about that.
It came out in 2001 or 2002.
So that would have been PS2?
No, it was a PC, I think.
Okay.
It was a PC game.
Yeah, PC.
See, whenever I hear about a video game from the past, I'm like, what year, what console? Does anyone talk in it, or is am I allowed to just read it? You know, like that's my big barrier. I'm like, is this going to be somebody talking, or can I just read this? You know,
I don't know if there's any voice acting in it. Like it's from this. No, I haven't.
I can't find it now.
Unaming, have you played it? You've played it, have you?
I have not. No, I haven't played it, but I've watched many clips of it. And let me tell you, it was worth it.
Yes.
Just for, oh, only for my own research, you know.
Una, stream it, man. Come on. No, stream the shit out of it. Experimental, you know, streaming.
I'd actually cry. I think I'd just be wincing in the corner and just being like, I can't.
We're going to take a break from this painful subject to let you know about another show, which you might be interested in, which is brought to you by the Headstuff Podcast Network. I don't have all the details, but basically...
My name is Stephanie Preisner, and my podcast is called Basically with Stephanie Preisner, and I have guests on every week who explain things to me because they're experts and I'm not. We've had people like Pascal Donoghue, the Minister for Finance, explain what it's like to be the Minister for Finance. We've had on Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, explain what it's like to be Taoiseach. Luke O'Neill explain the coronavirus. A nurse explaining what it's like to get coronavirus. And then loads of things that aren't related to coronavirus at all. Like politics and being a child actor. If you like finding out about things, listen to Basically with Stephanie Preisner.
But if you are looking, actually, Sarah, if you are looking for a game where it's mostly text-based and set in Ireland, Folklore is probably a good shout for that.
Yeah, did I read about this recently?
Well, I love it because they actually pitched it in a really funny way. It's set in the fictional town of Doolin.
Oh yeah, Doolin is real.
And it's thankfully mostly text-based, so that means like we obviously don't get so many weird accents. And it does have that kind of stereo. Patter, you like this too, because though it's set in Doolin, you know, it focuses on this Celtic other world of Irish mythology.
Of course it fucking does.
But you know what's particularly great about it in the cutscenes? Because I was looking, I was like, how fictional is this Doolin? Like, what are they going to do with it?
Where's the hotel at? Like,
yeah, I know, right? And what they do get right, which is very random and amusing, is that, you know, the way in, I know, down here anyway, our signposts are like white with black outlines to them.
Yes.
Yeah, so they get those in them. I was like, fair play. And also they have our Irish post boxes, which I'm very happy with. You know, the
old school ones. Oh, that's good. A nice detail. Oh, green post boxes.
No, sorry, not post boxes. Telephones. The white ones. You know, the ones, the classic ones.
Oh, yeah, I know the ones. But like, what I like about Folklore, what I find hilarious about it is that like, they've done that level of research to get the signposts and the phone boxes right. But like, it came out in 2007 and they didn't fucking Google to see if there's a real place called Doolin.
Oh,
Will we just make sure there's no place called Doolin? No, it'd be grand. Be grand.
Now
throw it in.
The path.
It's grand. It's no problem.
I think they probably did it like base it on some, they probably did see a name and thought that sounds very good. But I know that when I was reading some reviews of it and they were saying like, I can't believe that this isn't a real place. And everyone was like, actually, you know, just look at Google there now. You just have to do a quick search. And I'm like, oh my God, it is real. Fair play.
The idea that these games that are set in Ireland that like have any sort of gradient of the island that we live on, that they're curios rather than mainstream titles or even like widely known indie titles. Do you know? Like, it's beyond left of center. Like, I remember feeling, I feel like, you've played Bioshock, right?
I have played some of Bioshock Infinite, yeah.
Yeah, I did not enjoy my Bioshock experiences, but there was one of them where there's the opening sequence is that you have to watch like the public stoning of an Irish man whose partner is a woman of colour.
Mm-hmm, and, yeah, that's Infinite,
It was literally at that point that I was like, fuck your game. And I just turned it off and I was like, I hate this now. I was like, not interested. Don't fucking try and do edgy shit at me. But I thought that was a really compelling use of Irishness, you know, not like an interrogation, but more of a way to show white people and frame them in a sort of exotic manner. Do you know?
Yeah.
Like a white person, but like not really like a white person, do you know? Which is such a bullshit construct anyway, which is why I was like, I hate this game. I'm out.
There is actually a great example of Irish accent acting in Bioshock Infinite, funny enough. Because he's played by an Irish actor, which always helps. It really does.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It's almost like we're a whole nation with people who they can employ, but you know.
I know, right? Yeah. And I never understand that because there are still very few people who can do the accent right to an acceptable level. And I've heard people try over and over. And I'm sure that I'm also terrible at doing an American or a British accent. But if I was going to do something, especially in AAA games like Bioshock Infinite or whatever, I would absolutely hire an Irish person because you can afford it. You can, you know, you can afford all these great actors to do the job. So I never understand that.
As well as the fact that, and it's one thing in a film, you might have a case where the star is the draw and they say it's easier for like Jared Butler to have a go at an Irish accent than just to get someone with an Irish accent who people might know. And I know that, say, whereas in a video game, very few people will buy a video game because of the star. So they can actually just go ahead and get a voice actor who can do the work.
You know, you're dead right. We don't have generally, there isn't we don't feature actors in video games in a way that's meant to be a draw. But Hideo Kojima pulled that recently with Norman Reedus and Mads Mikkelsen.
Yeah, that new game.
Yeah, Death Stranding. My husband's been playing Death Stranding, the Amazon delivery box dystopia game, where you play Norman Reedus, who walks around with a jar on his belly, which has a tiny baby in it. That's what I've gleaned that it's about. But that the unusual thing about it as a piece of work is that it that was undeniably Norman Reedus. Like, that was the actor as the model, you know? Like, that's who that was. You know, that's the face and everything.
That's been done quite a bit recently, though. Wasn't Ellen Page in a video game?
Yeah, she was in Beyond
Two
Souls.
Heavily featured. Yeah, and what about The Last of Us as well? It's very clearly her as well.
Yeah, the first one was not so much the second one. I can see where they got away with that for the second one, but definitely the first one, her likeness was pretty clear, and they got in a lot of trouble about that, even though it wasn't actually played by her technically voice actor wise. But she did have her own video game with William Dafoe, Beyond Two Souls, and they both played the likeness was they were both them. That was an interesting. Oh, speaking of Irishness, sorry, just for 2 seconds. Particularly in that game, one of the lead characters was called Aiden, but they mispronounced it. So for the entire game, you hear Aiden.
Weird.
Oh, yeah. Christ.
I know, it made me really sad.
So much money goes into the development of these games, the big ones in particular, the big studio games, and yet just simply researching how to do that right. And it makes me think, when you play a game that has other elements of other cultures in it, how much are they getting fucking wrong? Realize.
I think the writing departments of AAA studios are chronically underattended to in a way that is heartbreaking, because the people who write video games are writing from a very different medium point than anybody who writes narrative fiction or nonfiction or anything. Because to write a video game, you're writing in a sequences of choices. You know, so choice-oriented storytelling is super complicated. It's a very, very different medium. So the people who have to do this kind of writing have to be really on the ball. But unfortunately, in a lot of AAA games, the budget simply isn't put into teams of writers who are always the most artistic. You know,
sensitive to those kinds of concerns and what.
Yeah, or research-oriented. The money, the budgets get pumped into the visuals.
This brings up something, though. Aside from Animal Crossing, the game I've seen discussed most online is, some people have described it as a kind of a comment on colonialism. It's the Untitled Goose Game.
Oh, yeah. Fabulous.
In which case, this thing, not just Australian, but obviously it's set in an English village and the goose is causing trouble. And in the end credits of the Untitled Goose Game, it says, this game was made on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay respects to their elders, past and present. Sovereignty was never ceded. Thank you very much for playing our video game.
You love to see it.
Nice. Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's not very often you see stuff like that.
Completely. And I think it speaks to a lot of the fact that, with a lot of video games, when you have, as you say, choice-based decisions, makes decision-based storytelling, And then, while obviously, in addition to Irish characters or characters from others, there's also a lot of games have a colonial, particularly maybe set in space or otherwise, there's a colonial undercurrent, which is often there, and the decisions that are awarded often reflect a certain colonial mindset. Would that be fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. Collecting items is accruing capital, mm-hmm. right?
Turning people to coins and taking them.
Coins, Clashtini, right? There's another game that does something very interesting with that accruing of capital and that idea of conquering, right? Is a game called Donut County.
Oh, so good.
So good. You play as a hole in the ground.
It's amazing.
You just go around.
Do you play
and you
as a hole in the ground?
You play you as do. A hole in the ground. It's absolutely phenomenal. Like, I think the two games that most directly on the nose kind of, I don't know if this is like a wild statement, given that there are games literally called things like Command and Conquer. But for me, two games that are kind of more directly about capitalism and the accruing of capital is Katamari Damacy.
Oh my God, it's another great game.
Banger, right? You just collect, you roll a small ball around. The story of Katamari Damacy is like a myth, right? The king of the cosmos came home drunk one night and he tripped and he fell and he knocked all the stars out of the sky. And you're his tiny son and you have to roll a magical ball around the planet Earth, collecting loads of bits and pieces and then throwing it up into the sky so it can become stars again, right?
Okay.
Lovely story. Dead simple. But you just collect stuff.
You just roll around. That's
just
it.
Gathering stuff. You just stuff. The only amount of stuff is just collect all the stuff, right? Whereas Donut County is you're a hole in the ground and you disappear stuff. Right? And Donut County is written in such a way that it actually is more overtly about corporation. You know, the baddie is an evil corporation and people gathering stuff is not a good thing. So I think they're both, while they're both kind of quite cartoonish and illustrated in a very intentional kind of stylized way, they both have like a commentary at their hearts, like the Goose Game. You know, a work of perfect absurdity, which is made by a team of people who are incredibly mindful of politics. So it finds its way in, right? That intentionality and observation, like it finds its way in, you know?
Can I just go back to Katamari Damacy there?
Yeah.
The protagonist is literally a royal, like an upper class nobility person who needs to accumulate more shit.
Plundering, destroying, knocking things over. Some of the things are even people. Yeah, you just. But it's very sweet. The music is amazing. You're tiny. you're so small. You're so tiny. And your dad hates you as well. Like, he's fully just like, you, my stupid tiny prince son. Did you get me many swans to turn into the star? And it's not enough. Fine, I'll take them. And so, then he sends you to get more. He hates you.
Like a kind of cute imperialism, like the way the Brits think of the British Empire.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, adorable imperialism. So cute. It's actually a really brilliant game. It's really, really unusual. Like, it's mechanically, it's not really like anything else, except maybe Donut County, which is inverted.
There was a game I used to play, and that's which I've avoided playing, and that I probably would not have written two books if I had, is Civilization, in which you can play as different different nations in history, and that's been widely criticized for rewarding colonial mindsets, breaking treaties, taking stuff, and conquering the world being possible, seen as a suitable objective to the end of the game. But some people have said that they've actually learned a bit about history and geography from playing Civilization. There was a few years ago during presidential primary debates, one of the Republican candidates thought that the pyramids were food storage because he'd been playing Civilization, and you get a granary in every city. You get a granary in every city when you build the pyramids wonder in Civilization. But then at the same time, though, I often see people who have, kind of wise quotes in maybe in their bios and their on LinkedIn or even Twitter, you know, where they'd say, it is not like Darwin saying, it is not the strongest of species that survive, but only those most adapted to change. And people say, well, that's fair. You must be very well read. And it's like, he got that from Civilization. He's faking it.
But games like that have been absolutely brilliant.
That is the thing. Could games like this possibly be used to teach Irish or increase knowledge of things like Irish history or even the Irish language? Like, could do people actually learn factual information about World War II from Call of Duty?
Oh, that's okay. That feels like a separate question as well.
Okay. I was just using that as one example, obviously, and I'm not sure. I know that some games have more detail than others in this regard.
I know that there's a simulation game called Crusader Kings and Crusader Kings 2, which is like you're a medieval royal, and your goal is basically to propagate and to accumulate more territory. But it's become famous among players of the game that Ireland is the easiest place to start. Because you don't even get invaded You don't even get invaded until 1172. So you can plan and you can build your dynasty in one of the Irish kingdoms beforehand. So much so that the nickname for Ireland in Crusader Kings 2 is Tutorial Island. But it has led to an awful lot of people who have played this game learning a lot about medieval Irish society, because it's very, very accurate around the dynasties and the kind of succession, the religion, the culture at the time. Like it's a very historically accurate game when it begins, and then you get to fuck around and like marry your daughter to the Byzantine emperor and like make alliances and shit like that, and you know, you get to play around and create an empire in your own image. But initially it's very, very historically on the nose, and it's taught a lot of people a lot of stuff about Ireland.
Interesting.
I haven't played that myself now, I have to say, but it's very, do you think they are actually learning about it, or is it that they're learning about it so that they can utilize all the information to be better at the game, if you know what I mean?
Oh, definitely the latter. But, you know, if you're learning, this is, as someone who used to be a teacher, if they're learning, I don't care why.
I mean, I'm hopefully not. People wouldn't have the bad taste to make a 1916 the computer game, or
I mean, we will live to see the day, you know, like.
Should you invade the post office or the biscuit factory or the hospital? Or start somewhere else. Maybe bomb all the train stations first.
From the makers of Theme Hospital and Theme Park, it's Theme Easter Rising.
No, yeah. It's going to happen.
It's a lovely day in Stephen's Green, and you are a horrible revolutionary.
I think there's one thing that I'm just waiting for, is that whenever I see Irish characters in video games, I'm just really particularly tired of them explaining that they're Irish for some reason. They always bring it up, and I never understand why. It's like, we can tell from
your accent.
But
that's a whiteness thing. That's 100% Americans. It's an American repackaging of Irishness, right? Largely. So it's 100% a differentiation within whiteness. Like, it's grotesque, frankly, that like they want to represent more white bodies on screen, but they want to do it in a way that feels like there's a slight difference, but not so much that they'd have to like make them French or anything, do you know? And Irishness allows an implemented characterization of, you know, the stage Irish or the American perspective of Irishness, which is, as we've discussed, drunk, dishonest, right? All those like fairly non-dangerous stereotypes, largely they're quite kind of mild, but I think it's 100% to do with that.
It just doesn't,
that's why they state it.
There's so many weird connections as well, because I know that when I was playing Tekken growing up, and then when I finally realized that apparently Nina and Anna Williams were from non-specified if it was the Republic of Ireland or Northern Ireland from their fandom page, but when the fact that they're Irish and their strange backstory, it just didn't really make any sense to me. And sometimes I feel like there's so much afterthought being shoved into it. But you're right, no, Sarah, I think it's just weirdly packaged all the time.
And exactly in the same way that largely if you're in America, an American will immediately tell you that they are Irish. It is the same thing. It doesn't mean the same thing to them as it does to us.
And I gotta say, it does hurt a bit, I think.
Oh, yeah. It's exhausting. It's just like, really? Again?
Yeah, okay. It's having your entire culture used as the acceptable face of whiteness.
Yes.
That's it. That's totally it.
100%. And I think it's up to us. And I think we all largely do a fairly robust job of it being like, nope, not fake idea. Don't do that to us. Nope, 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 nope. Don't do that. No, thank you. We've got our own bullshit over here. You leave us out of that.
We really have enough.
We're culpable for enough bullshit in American history without.
We have enough on our fucking plate without your nonsense.
But we are, like, because there's a culpability there.
Big style.
But, like, and yeah, it's this implied for. It's the like, again, like when I saw it in Bioshock, I was like, ah, fuck this. Like, I'm not. Like, you can't. Irishness is, as an accept, inverted commas, please. Like, acceptable whiteness is such bullshit, and reproducing that rhetoric within video games is super annoying, because we should be past that, but we are not. So, you know.
Yeah. And then when it comes to video games, actually the representation of video games in Ireland, it's really frustrating, because I find that the media doesn't take it seriously at all, and they still don't get it, which is one of those things where if I'm asked to do something, they're like, yes, but like, what's a video game? And I was like, come on.
Yeah. Sure. One of the most watched streamers in the fucking world is from like Mullingar.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know?
Yeah.
Like Jacksepticeye arguably has the more viewers than any Irish influencer alive. Right. But does the Irish press ignore, like, not that I'm saying you should, I'm not like standing anybody here, but just objectively, it's nuts to me that we don't as a country, like, acknowledge, as a media, don't acknowledge it, or the fact that massive esports people are coming out of this country and they're just not even being looked at all.
Yeah, it's terrible. And it's really frustrating because even I was speaking to someone recently about this, and there's an Irish speedrunner who is a top in the world for Metal Gear Solid in his category. MGS3. And I wrote about him.
Okay.
Yeah. And he does it on the hardest difficulty. And he was invited over to GDQ, Games Done Quick, one of the biggest events in the charity events in the world that raises millions.
It's amazing. It's
amazing. It's so good. But like, no one covered his story and I couldn't believe it. And I was like, why? You know, this is a real deal. These are amazing achievements that Irish people are making. But because you don't get it, you're not willing to reach out and acknowledge it. And it just makes me really sad, especially when we have record holders in Ireland who are there just behind the scenes doing the thing. And it's depressing.
So I think what you're saying is actually more specific, and it's frustrating to me too. And but I'm not even a streamer in the way that you are, you know. But in the way that I think it is a little bit to do with like, the youth of video games as a medium. So between, let's say, for argument's sake, Pong, right? Mm. And today, it's about 41, 42 years-ish. I could be wrong. Any pedantic people who want to tweet me on Twitter to tell me that I'm wrong about the exact year. It's 40-ish years, right? In the history of cinema, from the first little black and white roly like pictograph things to Citizen Kane was about 40 splash years.
Yeah, from like from the Lumiere, right? Brothers, yeah.
So timeline-wise, we should be, not that I'm saying we should be coming up on the Citizen Kane of games, the Goose Game, the Citizen Kane of games. Not that I'm saying exactly that. But in terms of the evolution of a medium, the evolution of art, and the like, when a medium figures out how it works, and then people start to be able to use it as a tool of expression as well as just a functioning entertainment machine, then that's when we start getting the real good shit, right? So when does the study and the discourse and the media actually emerge in a mainstream way around that? Probably not for another, like, good couple of years. Now, keep in mind, technology accelerates and the internet and whatever, it adds a very, very different layer onto that conversation. But I don't think we're likely to see a video games column in the Irish Times anytime soon. Now, sting me, like, please prove me wrong, but it still feels newer to most people than it actually is.
I know they had one for a while and then they just continued.
I'm just going to pull Sarah up on our dates there. Would you believe it's closer to 50 years? It's 48 years since Pong came out.
Jesus, okay, so... So our Citizen Kane would have been a couple
exactly.
years ago.
But that said, film studies kind of really only emerged in the 20s and the 30s. So like you say, 40, 50 years after the medium was unveiled for the first time, people started caring about it enough to write about it.
Exactly. And we live in a culture that is more... like everything is moving so quickly. Like there isn't critical language around YouTube, say. There isn't even dedicated like highbrow broadsheet writing about YouTube, though it has more viewers largely day to day than like RTE. Do you know what I mean? There's a disparity between who's producing the media and who's consuming the media, especially with video games, because like
it is true that
people don't play them of a certain age, you know.
And even like, because when Clive James died recently, they were talking about how there's no real you didn't have TV people writing about television much before he came along, and that was an entire section of the newspaper that barely didn't exist until they effectively let him have a go at it because they couldn't let him be the film critic for some reason because of the internal politics, whatever newspaper he was writing for at the time. And now, obviously, people often find maybe that the actual, like, say, the Patrick Frayne's kind of TV journalism and things like that are often people's favorite part of. or something people go straight to, and there is a discourse around people, the way we talk about television is completely different because the way they eventually changed the way they wrote about it, people wrote about it, and it took that moment. I mean, maybe I think there was, things were different then in print media when there was a certain amount of pages to be filled or slots to be filled, and it all works differently now. Mm. But I've written about it in podcasts at the moment. You don't generally get kind of podcast. Most articles about podcasts are like, what is a podcast? You know, they used to just this, but now there's some interesting podcasts being made. And you think that's in the third decade of podcasting, you expect kind of a little bit more detail.
Well, I was a roadie for Welcome to Night Vale in 2016. Yeah. And that was like, podcasting was a very different world back there then, right? But like when I started, I wrote about podcasting every week for the Irish Times for a year until the formatting of the ticket changed, and five columnists were let go, which is kind of normal, like things change over. But something I've heard, so I chat away to lads in podcasting a fair bit, but there isn't really that much mainstream newsprint coverage of podcasts, and that doesn't always go back to, has anybody listened to Serial?
Yes.
Serial, anybody? Do you know? Because that's the only one that broke through. This American Life, my guys, you know, like there's, because there's so much choice out there, similarly to YouTube, that the podcasts I listen to are never going to be the same kind of podcasts as you guys listen to, because we can be so selective. However, if you think the people who run legacy media listen to podcasts that aren't the big Serials and this American Lives of the world, maybe Radio Lab at a push, you're wrong. Of course they don't.
But you know, I think the thing is that you don't, like, for a lot of music criticism, and for me growing up kind of watching things like Top of the Pops and stuff, when I was let, there's no real official podcast chart, and that people that you can say, yes, this, that say if a show drops 18 places in the charts or goes up 20 places in the charts over a week, like that would be a big story in music, and it would be something people would talk about on a music show. But you don't get that in podcast reviewers, the idea that they might talk about something being a certain show being as big as a headline show on Today FM or RTE, but they won't talk about, oh, this show's been steadily growing for the past, you know, 3 weeks, that there's a real buzz around here. So you never really get kind of people talking about kind of as trends as they happen in podcasting.
No. Podcasting is, I believe, is one of the last subcultural mediums, because again, people will only listen to what they want to listen to. You know, it's something, I think it's YouTube actually, and podcasting are inherently subcultural, you know, and that is why they're not getting covered in the way that mainstream media makes me feel kind of gross, but I don't mean it in that way. I'm not being a Joe Rogan about it, you know what I mean, but like I mean that literally the mainstream media will cover it. I think it's kind of beautiful really that podcasts remain this outpost, you know, this sort of wild west where you can kind of just make a thing about something that you care about, and maybe loads of people will listen to it, or maybe just the people who really love it, or maybe like five people, do you know? So I think the medium has endless possibilities.
I think with podcasting and with video games, one thing that like ties the two of them together is that I don't think it's possible for a kind of a genre of journalism revolving around them to develop in the way that TV journalism or film studies as an academic study, or even film critics as a piece within the media. I don't think they can develop the same way independently, because everything is now connected and everything is instant and everything is personalized, and you have subcultures within subcultures. You didn't have that when somebody started, like Clive James started to write about telly for the first time.
Yeah,
like
shows even came out Charlie every Booker, week.
You can't write a regular column.
No, there was a week between shows. Do you know what I mean? Now, if I want to write like a really sharp cover story on like Russian Doll, I got to watch all that shit in one night, and I got to make sure my thinking, like, I mean, TV critics in the year of our Lord 2020 blow my mind, because that is a harder schedule than anybody had to keep. So you can't do it with podcasts because they show up too quickly, you know?
Yeah, and we've seen what happened within video game journalism. There's a toxicity as well out there.
Una, what's your take on that kind of stuff?
In terms of video game journalism or the aspects? Because I know when I had to when I was really interested in video games in general, but I know when I was kind of touting myself as focusing in on just video games, there was like, yeah, you can do that, but you also have to do the entertainment side of things. So we're going to expect you to write about the Kardashians. And I was like, oh, okay. So what percentage of articles do I have to write here? It's like, yeah, you know what? Maybe one video game article and then maybe 30 articles that are not to do with video games. And that was really hard and depressing because it kind of, when you're told that you're, I suppose, what your work or your passion isn't good enough for what the audience wants or whatever, it's kind of like you're not really giving it a chance because it could be what they want. But the fact that the ratio is so low, you know, how is it ever going to be the thing that they want in the long run? So I think that when you're working in entertainment writing, it's really tricky because, like Patter, you're saying, like, you can't just really focus in on one thing. You're kind of expected now to be an all-rounder, at least with different topics. I feel you rarely get journalists who focus in on a singular topic, and if they do, it's because they've already built the profile for themselves to do so, which is fair enough. Like, you know, they've gotten that far and it's great, but it makes it much harder for people to break into, of course, the industry, which is hard enough as it is, because there are exceptionally good video game writers like yourself, Sarah.
Thank you.
Yeah, yay. Fantastic. No, I love reading your stuff.
I can't believe I'm allowed to. I only get to do it once every couple of months. But that's the thing. It's not like I'm a full-time games writer. It's just like every so often there's a little spot where I can go and do it. It's very passion-driven because I can't hang my hat on it. I simply can't. You know, I occasionally write about video games for The Guardian, and I pitch all the time. Do you know? But like, you know yourself, you have to make sure that pitch. Like, I'm really bad at pitching because I write long things. I write
it's
novels.
It's daunting,
you know?
Anyway.
Pitches are short and hard, real hard. But you know, every so often one sticks, and also there's a timeline. Do you know what I mean? And within the crushing moment that we're in journalism at the moment, budgets are really, really tight. Do you know? So it's not a cheerful time to be writing for any newspaper. But I think, Petter, were you going to bring up Gamergate before I scooted us all off left field there? Sorry.
No, just the toxicity around Gamergate, and like, it's just another sort of stumbling block out there. Just the fact that exists, that misogyny and the associated racism and all sorts of just horrendous shit that is unfortunately associated with gaming as a subculture, that's out there as well, which is another stumbling block in the way of progressive voices trying to make it a mainstream experience, if you know what I mean.
Oh, absolutely. Did you guys watch Gamergate as it happened, or were you late to the tale?
I was late to the tale. There's so much going on. Yeah.
I was late to the tale as well, but
kind of on
I hate to tell you, but I watched that shit unfold.
Oh,
I was living in San Francisco at the time, and I was gripped by it. Absolutely gripped by it every day, watching different posts going up and the raids. And it was really, around the time I was considering trying, because I was, you know, near enough Silicon Valley, a lot of game development studios are out in the Bay. And I thought maybe I might be able to vaguely approach trying to write about games back then. Absolutely ran a mile, 100% ran a mile from it, because I was like, this is 100% not worth it. Ultimately, what I think it's about, aside from misogyny, because that's what it's about, is that it's about people who perceive video games as consumer objects, right? And the growing hostility over the years around games not being satisfactory, i.e. featuring too many people of color or featuring, inverted commas, political agendas, i.e. equality of some description, not even parity, like, but, you know, approaching progressiveness. The pushback that you see from the consumer market treats the game like a imperfect or in some way faulty object, rather than as an expression, right? So, and you see that as you go into kind of Star Wars and other sort of, I use nerd culture very loosely here, but you know what I mean. There's an entitled consumer demographic who are, if the toy they bought is not satisfactory, they will shout about the toy, which negates all of the game studies. It negates all of the talking about them in a critical way that's like, uses film theory or uses literary theory, it completely wipes it out and it stops the conversation. And when Gamergate happened, it actually, I think it really halted a lot of fledgling theorists and cultural critics who were coming up through the ranks. They were, especially women and queer people and people of color, were like, absolutely fuck this, no way, and quit. Do you know? Because the working environments and the working conditions are too hostile. If your readers hate you, then why are you writing for them, right?
Yeah. So before we wrap up, and obviously there's a whole topic in Gamergate there as well. You both, Unaming and Sarah, both have books out at the moment. Excellent books, which our listeners would love to know more about. Maybe you could, before we wrap up, you could get just to tell us about your most recent book.
Oh, yeah, sounds like, go for it, yeah.
This sounds like we're pitching.
I suppose
I wrote my book last year, my God. Unshaw is the name of it, even though I pronounce it Unsaw, but anyway, sure look. It's a book on my childhood growing up in Kerry, Irish kind identity and racism and just generally things to do with the Irish language. So it's a memoir, it's a short read, a quick one. You'll probably read in one night, but it's kind of one of those tributes I ultimately wanted to do for my granddad and my mom. So yeah. That's it.
Fantastic. And Sarah?
I write books too. My two novels, my two works of fiction, I guess, are Other Words for Smoke, which came out in 2019 and won the Irish Book Award for Young Adult Fiction, and Spare and Found Parts, which is a queer retelling of Frankenstein. It came out in 2017, I think. Recently, but not that recently. Those are that and my nonfiction collection of essays, Not Lost, should be available in all good bookstores. You can also follow me at Grifsky on Twitter, where I post good memes. Well, bad memes, but you know.
Great stuff.
Spicy memes. Spicy memes. Dank memes.
Crunchy.
The best.
Yeah, yeah.
The crunchier, the better.
Yeah. Thank you both so much for educating me on games and the world around them. And I hope our listeners enjoy that. So until next time, it's a slán from me.
It's a slán, Ramsha.
Slán, Tamaline.
Slán!
Excellent. Mind yourselves. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of Motherfucklore. And thank you so much to Unamain and Sarah for being such great guests. Motherfucklore comes out every Friday in the Hestuff Podcast Network. If you're looking for some other Irish language content to keep you going, we're very happy to recommend some other stuff that's happening at the moment. Every week we like to put the spotlight on another Irish language creator. This week I'd like to tell you about a podcast called Daily Dose of Gaeilge. It is by Cliannaigh Colleagh, and it focuses on leading search subjects, strophic tour, poems, things like that, and is quite accessible. If you want to support the continued production of Motherfucklore, visit patreon.com/Darek. People who support us on Patreon get access to bonus material, discounts, and a range of other goodies. That's what we're doing. Thanks a million to Kirsten Scheel for doing the artwork this week. Thanks to Brian for production. If you want to contact the show, you can contact us at motherfucklore@headstuff.org. That's our email address. At the Irish Four on Twitter. That's me. And we have a Facebook page too. Motherfucklore. Stroke the Irish Four. In the meantime, it's long a fall.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
You're so small. You're so tiny.